You are listening to Aftersight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor Weekly Digital Edition. My name is Daniel Williams. Today is Friday, October 31st, 2025. Happy Halloween. And I'll be reading from the Weekly Digital Edition and following up with articles from the News and Middle East sections if there's time. We begin this week in the Arts and Culture section. In an extraordinary film, an Iranian director explores forgiveness and mercy. It Was Just an Accident was made in secret by Jafar Panahi. This is written by OWN Films contributor Peter Rainier. And there's also a photo at the top of the page. So in this photo, we see three of the actors. They are out in a desert. It appears there is a driver of this vehicle. This man has a thick black mustache. He's wearing a blue t-shirt and faded jeans. And he is standing in the desert. Right beside him is a newly married couple. They look pretty disturbed. It appears their car may have broken down. Something's happened. They're in a van or a truck out in the middle of a desert. You can see the woman in a wedding gown, and the gentleman has his white shirt and black pants on from being married. So let's get to this article. The backstory to It Was Just an Accident, the extraordinary movie from the Iranian director Jafar Panahi, is integral to its meaning. Winner of the 2025 Palme d'Or at Cannes, that festival's highest honor, it's about the ways revenge and mercy play out among a group of ordinary citizens who suffered the tyrannies of the Islamic Republic. Panahi himself has famously endured the ongoing wrath of a regime of which he has been openly critical. In 2010, he was sentenced to 6 years in prison, later commuted to house arrest, plus a 20-year ban on filmmaking. He repeatedly circumvented the ban, filming in secret. One of his clandestine movies, the acclaimed 2011 video memoir, This Is Not a Film, was shot on an iPhone and smuggled out of Iran on a USB stick. Accident is his first film since his latest arrest in 2022, when, after almost 7 months in detention, he was released after undergoing a hunger strike. No longer subject, at least for now, to a travel ban, he has accompanied his new film to festivals and screenings around the world. But as with his other films, he had to direct it in secret, in part because its lead women violated the law by not wearing hijabs. Panahi has stated that Accident derives in part from anecdotes he heard from fellow prisoners. Because he is first and foremost a storyteller, the movie is framed as a kind of slow-burn thriller. His rage at the brutal system is palpable, but not propagandist. He understands that humanity and not hatred ultimately drives his scenario. It all begins when Eggball, played by Ibrahim Azizi, a middle-aged man driving at night on a country road, accidentally hits a dog, damaging his car's engine. With his young daughter and pregnant wife in tow, he finds a local mechanic, Vahid, played by Vahid Mobasari, who comes to believe that Eggball is the officer who tortured him in captivity years before. Because Vahid was blindfolded the entire time he was imprisoned, he can't be absolutely sure that Eggball, who, like his torturer, has a prosthetic leg, is the real culprit. After kidnapping him, Vahid prepares to bury him alive in the desert, despite Eggball's furious denials, but relents. With Eggball bound and gagged in the van, Vahid, that same day, seeks out four other former victims of the torturer's handiwork. Shiva, played by Miriam Ashfari, a feisty wedding photographer. Goli, played by Hadis Pakbatin, a bride-to-be still wearing her wedding dress, her groom Ali, played by Majid Panahi, and the hot-headed Hamid, played by Muhammad Ali Al-Masir. They all pile into the van as it makes its rounds through the city streets and the hills above Tehran. Like Vahid, none of them as prisoners ever saw Iqbal's face. They can't be certain they have the right man, although Hamid is in favor of disposing of him anyway. What ensues over the course of a day and night is a kind of black comic roundelay, in which each of the participants voices their full-throated recriminations and doubts. Squabbling in and out of that overcrowded van, they're like a dysfunctional family wailing their pent-up woes. Without being explicit about it, Panahi has crafted a morality play. Is Iqbal really the torturer these people nicknamed Peg Leg? Although the truth finally comes out, the stakes are much the same either way. What are the limits of forgiveness, of mercy? In seeking revenge, do the members of this cohort risk losing their souls? The film's moral issues don't come across as tacked on. They arise organically and register as both intensely personal to the filmmaker and much larger in scope. The film even offers up, against all odds, in a truly chilling final moment, a measure of hope. Vahid may bemoan his ruined life, but Panahi, who has suffered for his art, remains undaunted. This film is his Exhibit A. It Was Just an Accident is rated PG-13 for thematic elements, violence, strong language, and smoking. For our next article, we remain in the arts and culture section. The title of this article, he wrote some of the most aching lyrics, then musicals left him behind. Director Richard Linklater offers a poignant portrait of legendary lyricist Larry Hart in Blue Moon. This was also written by OWN Film's Peter Rainier. At the bottom of the page, we have a photograph. It is of the actors Margaret Qualley and Ethan Hawke, who star in Blue Moon. In the photograph, Qualley has long blonde hair. She has a golden colored dress, golden gloves that go up to her elbows, and she's in profile and looking over her shoulder at the person taking the photograph with kind of a smirk on her face. Ethan Hawke is dressed in a navy suit with a white shirt and a dark tie, and he has a very dramatic comb over. His hair is combed all the way over his head, and he looks very serious as he looks into the camera. So let's look at the article now. Hollywood has always been overly fond of depicting the lives of creative artists as deeply troubled. Geniuses, apparently, must be shown to suffer for their art. One artist, however, who definitely did live such a life was Lawrence Hart, the subject of the mostly marvelous Richard Linklater movie Blue Moon, starring Ethan Hawke. It opens with a quote from the great cabaret singer Mabel Mercer, who said that Hart was the saddest man I ever knew. Known affectionately as Larry, Hart was one half of the Broadway musical theater dream team of Richard Rodgers and Hart. He was responsible for some of the most pungent and expressive showbiz lyrics of all time, including not only Blue Moon, but also such classics as My Funny Valentine, The Lady is a Tramp, Bewitched, Bothered, and Bewildered, and Isn't It Romantic. Together, Rodgers and Hart collaborated on more than 24 musicals. But Hart's alcoholism and emotional disruptions eventually undid the partnership. Rodgers moved on, collaborating with Oscar Hammerstein II on a string of colossal hits, starting with Oklahoma, that eclipsed even his work with Hart. 8 months after Oklahoma opened, Hart died in his late 40s. Blue Moon, scripted by Robert Kaplow, who also wrote the novel Me and Orson Welles, which was turned into a vastly underrated Linklater movie of the same name, takes place almost entirely in one night. The March 31, 1943 premiere of Oklahoma has just let out, and its cast and creators are heading to a celebration at Sardi's, the famed Theater District hangout. Hart, who attended the premiere, left for the party before the final act. He is already ensconced on a bar stool as the celebrants, including Rodgers and Hammerstein, file in. He masks his boozy bitterness with an all-too-transparent bonhomie. He knows Oklahoma will be a hit, bigger than any he had with Rodgers, played superlatively well here with a complex blend of deep affection and diffidence by Andrew Scott. Hart even admires the show, in a way, as a perfect piece of kitsch. But he can't abide its all-American sunniness. His deep-down cynicism is roiled by a lyric like, "The corn is as high as an elephant's eye." He even objects to the exclamation point in the musical's title. What gives the movie much of its poignancy and power is Hart's realization, and ours, that the asperity and regret showcased in his famous lyrics are no longer in fashion. He knows his time is past. Hawk is not the first actor I would have thought of to play Hart, who sported a glossy comb-over and measured less than 5 feet tall. I can't say I entirely bought the transformation, despite some unobtrusive camera placements and subtle facial prosthetics, but Hawk gives it his all. He and Linklater have worked together on 9 movies, including the great Before trilogy, and their creative simpatico is obvious. Hawk's Hart talks almost nonstop in Blue Moon, and yet I never tired of listening to his patter. What he says, so often at odds with how he feels, issues from a hurt place. His psychological contradictions play out in full force. Although discreetly gay, he is rapturously in love with one of the partygoers, Elizabeth Weiland, played by the extraordinary Margaret Qualley. He has been corresponding with her, a Yale-y socialite, and she, ambitious but kindly, indulges his affections. At first, she comes across as flighty, but at a scene between her and Hart in a cloakroom near the end, bears their romantic souls. We can see how both of these people in their separate ways are caught up in a forlorn, unattainable love. Hart disparages Oklahoma in the movie for being nostalgic about a world that never existed, but the yearning in many of his best lyrics is for an unrequited ardor that is equally beyond reach. Blue Moon might essentially take place inside a single room, but it rarely feels stagey. It captures the connivance and conviviality of theater people, the way they come together, if only for a night, with a spiritedness that is both forced and entirely genuine. A success like Oklahoma makes them feel anointed. It is in the giddy maelstrom that Hart at long last seems most at home and most alone. Blue Moon is rated R for language and sexual references. We now turn to our next article, Books for Global Readers, is where it appears in the magazine. The article is titled, In the Memoir Joyride, Susan Orlean Turns Her Investigative Eye Inward. This article was written by Sky Davis, a contributor. At the top of the page, we see the author Susan Orlean. She is at her farm, and she is surrounded by burros. There are 3 of them nuzzling her. It appears she might have carrots or something of that nature in her hands. Susan Orlean is a middle-aged woman. She has long red hair, and she is wearing a black outfit that is accentuated by green scarves that she has tied around both her arms and around her waist. And again, she is out on a farm area. And then below that, we do see the dust jacket, the front cover of the book. It is titled Joyride. You see Joyride going across the page in bold purple print at the top of the page. In the middle of the page, there's a photograph that's kind of turned, it's kind of cocked just a little bit, just a little bit of a, it's not quite straight. So it's kind of turned sideways just a little bit. And it's a picture, it appears to be, of the author, Susan Orlean, riding in a convertible. And then below the photograph in red or orange lettering is the author's name in bold print, Susan Orlean. So let's look at the article now. Susan Orlean appears on my screen in a glowing burst in what seems to be a reverse greenhouse. She sits in a glassed-in structure with a mass of tropical plants just on the other side. A 5-foot-tall Queen of Hearts playing card stands next to her. She doesn't mention it. This, she tells me, is her writing office, nestled in the hills of Los Angeles, but one could be forgiven for thinking she was reporting from a more exotic locale. After all, I'm speaking with one of the most celebrated journalists and writers of narrative nonfiction, a genre that uses literary and experiential techniques to report on its subjects. Orlean is the author of the breakout book, The Orchid Thief, which inspired Charlie Kaufman's script for the Spike Jonze film, Adaptation. Orlean's role was played by Meryl Streep. She also wrote the New York Times bestselling The Library Book, an investigation into the 1986 fire at the Los Angeles Central Library. On the page, she's known for a keen reporting sensibility and for adding herself into the narrative. Now she turns that investigative eye inward for her memoir, Joyride. She decided on the title because joy and exploration are at the core of her artistic and reporting practice. It's also a bit of a wink at the other meaning of joyride, she says, flashing an almost imperceptible smile. Orlean speaks at length, falling into a kind of absorbing digression, where for a moment you're unsure where she's taking you, but she always seems to swerve right back to the point. Several times in our conversation, she stopped herself, pausing, then redirected her answer with laser precision. "Let me put that differently," she asked once, doubling back, and later, mid-answer, she looked off camera saying, "No, I'm not going to do anything with that," an out loud answer to a presumably internal train of thought. This layered approach to our conversation is reflected in her work. In The Orchid Thief, she reports on an incident in which a man steals rare ghost orchids from a Florida swamp at the behest of and aided by the local Seminole tribe. This entry point leads to a sprawling exploration of the obsessive world of orchid collectors, Native American history, and other fascinating topics, going 4 or 5 layers deeper than any other writer-investigator might go. By Orlean's own admission, she tends to go rabbit hole. She does this with her other best-selling books, including one about the famous film star dog Ren 10-10. In Joyride, Orlean says there was so much material to uncover about Ren 10-10 that the text took her 10 years to write, longer than her son had been alive at that point. She remarks that her son probably thought his mother's whole job was writing a book about a dog. When asked about turning that investigative lens inward, Orlean gives a surprising answer. "At first, it was very awkward," she says. "I spent a lot of time before I began feeling like, I just don't know how to do this. I don't understand how I could look at myself as a subject." Despite her many accomplishments, Orlean truly doubted that anyone was interested in her life. Orlean had so much trouble at the beginning stages of the project that she hired a friend to interview her, reversing her usual role, becoming the interviewee rather than the interviewer. This seemed to kickstart the process for her. From then on, everything clicked into place. What follows is the development of a career and a creative practice, one marked by incredible skill, preternatural intuition, and extraordinary fortune. Orlean started off at Alt Weekly magazines in Portland, Oregon, which she acknowledges offhandedly is a type of outlet that no longer exists. Finding leads from billboards, signs on lampposts, rumors, and people on the fringes, alongside the usual techniques in the journalist's toolbox. From the outside, this seems like an unusual and unreliable way to find material, but it always seemed to work out for Orlean, who tracks down stories with an uncanny precision. At this time in her life, she reported on the influx of Hmong immigrants to the city, experimental musicians playing in abandoned warehouses, shocking crimes, an eccentric architect who threw it all away to become a puppeteer, and many others. Her process, as she realized, was not becoming an expert in any one area, but always existing as the perpetual beginner, diving into new worlds and subcultures, always chasing the drive of ignorance into knowledge. Later, as her career grew, she wrote stories for Rolling Stone and became contributor to The New Yorker in 1987, joining as a staff writer in 1992. She sold her first book Saturday night on a phone call with an editor interested in an entirely different project. Since then, she has produced 8 more. When asked about her propensity for immersing herself in her stories rather than remaining an observer, Orlean focused in with an intensity that she hadn't displayed before. "I feel like those things can coexist quite comfortably," she says. "You feel like it's a delicate thing to both deliver deeply researched historical or contemporary information and then manage somehow to also write the more intimate first-person stuff." In her work now, she deftly balances both roles, dancing across the razor's edge as skillfully as an acrobat. As this is a memoir going back some 25-odd years and even further to her childhood, I felt it prudent to ask her about the reliability of memory as a reporting tool. "The word to live and die by is transparency," Orlean says. "Readers are smart, and you can say to them, this is how I remember it. I see no gray area between true versus imagined in my reported pieces. None of that is acceptable to me. In memoir, it's trickier because you are relying on your own flawed memory." As I prepared to move on to another question, Orlean sunk her teeth into the subject a little deeper. "It worries me terribly that I get asked by some journalism students, is it okay if some of what you write isn't true? And you think, yeah, it matters a lot. Well, does everything have to be true? And you think, well, wait, there's this amazing art form called fiction." Most of the world of journalism and publishing that Orlean came up in doesn't exist anymore. So more than anything, this memoir is a manual of sorts, a guidebook to the craft of nonfiction writing and the joy of the writing life. "Writers are both born and made," Orlean tells me. "I always looked at the world with curiosity and maybe more openness than the average bear. Anything strange or different, I think, oh, what's that about?" Remaining in the book section, we have another article here. The title, "A Writer Schools Himself on the Plight and Might of Birds." This article was written by Richard Horan, a contributor. And in the article, we have a couple of photographs. What we have are up-close pictures of birds. In the first one, we have a goldcrest resting in the palm of a hand. And the goldcrest is a, as its name suggests, it has some gold and brown in its feathers there. And it's a very small bird just resting in the palm of someone's hand. And then in the next photograph, we have a nuthatch perching on a branch. And the nuthatch is a small kind of round bird that has blue wings and also has a black strip going across its eyes. And think of it like a mask. It's like it's wearing a burglar's mask there. So very interesting. We also have a dust jacket for the book that's going to be talked about in this article. It's called Bird School, A Beginner in the Wood, written by Adam Nicholson, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, and it's 448 pages. The book is It's an orange-colored cover. And then very lightly in other shades of orange and red are many, many birds on there, but they are sort of ghosted. They're in sort of a silhouette type image and drawing of these birds. So let's get to the article. As a child in England, Adam Nicholson paid little attention to the birds. His father, the writer, publisher, and politician Nigel Nicholson, was no naturalist, always more interested in looking across a bit of country than in what it might be made of. It is this view addiction writ large that the son blames for nature's demise. The younger Nicholson launches an attempt to encounter birds, to engage with a whole and marvelous layer of life hitherto ignored. Nicholson builds a birdhouse for himself. Hexagonal, close to the woods, and big enough to sleep in, it serves as an observatory, a place to dissolve, if such a thing is possible. The boundary between self and world, he writes. This he does on a vast dairy farm in the Sussex Weald. In Bird School, A Beginner in the Wood, Nicholson presents himself as a part Christopher Robin, part Henry David Thoreau character, taking an ornithological jaunt around the Sussex Weald. He describes how he acquired knowledge of more than a dozen species and elaborates on their songs, nesting practices, feeding habits, fledgling activities, and migratory routes, and even ventures to discuss their states of mind. He starts with wrens but ends with people. Bird School is often a bit over the top as Nicholson's literary quirks seep in, bogging down the narrative with literary allusions and purple prose. But eventually Nicholson's naturalist heart modulates the narrative, revealing facts and anecdotes about the extraordinary capacity of birds to fire the imagination. One section involves blackbirds and Beethoven. It seems that male blackbirds compose permanently evolving and ever complicating songs as a way of keeping ahead of and intimidating their rivals. The composer, in his youth, would saunter the streets of Bonn, Germany, with ears perked and take notes. It is believed that Grosse Fugue Op. 133 was inspired by the songs of the Bonn blackbirds. Nicholson broaches the subject of humanity's impact on the avian world with a roll call of the regiments decimated in battle, of the catastrophic and in many cases relentless decline of the birds he anticipated seeing. It's a sobering list. The last chapter addresses the ultimate question. By feeding the birds, was I simplifying and homogenizing a bird population that had already suffered more than it should? And if I was, which way should I turn? His answer, spoiler alert, enable the woods to get scruffy around the edges, diversify, enrich, multiply, protect. Nicholson exhorts his readers not to be like the self-absorbed poet John Keats in his Ode to a Nightingale. Rather, consider the nightingale not a pet, nor a version of me or of anyone I know, but its own thing. Still just here, still wild, its own apostle for its own anxious future. Our next article comes from the In Pictures section, Photos and Story by Kang Chun Ching, a contributor. The title is Reaching the Height of Inclusion in Uganda. The dateline is Kampala, Uganda. I'll read the article and then share the photos with you. With the sun's golden rays streaming behind him, Miracle Ainamani shouts, "Rope!" a standard practice in case any fellow climbers are below him. Then he tosses a coil from the summit of Mayuinga Quarry. The rope has been threaded through chains bolted at the top, creating a secure line from which he will rappel 25 meters or 82 feet down. Mayinga is the only outdoor rock climbing crag in Kampala, Uganda's capital, but it is conveniently located for Mr. Ayanamani. The mobile money agent occasionally fits in a late afternoon climbing session before attending church in the evening. Mr. Ayanamani and other committed members of the Mountain Club of Uganda, or MCU, climb at the quarry up to three times a week. The MCU was established in 1945 by the Geography Department of Makerere University, with an initial focus on exploring nature and documenting the region's biodiversity, including the country's fabled gorillas. By 1953, the club had published a guidebook. The MCU's trajectory is upward bound. The number of members has soared from fewer than 20 in 2016 to more than 200 today. Nearly all of their gear has come from donations from foreign climbers and sports associations. Roughly a decade ago, previous club president Douglas Sabawa says there were only a handful of Ugandan MCU members. These days, 60% of new climbers are local and from all walks of life. Along with David Masika, the current president, and MCU members Albert Abeyo and Celine Jacobs, Mr. Sabawa is keen on increasing community exposure to the sport. This group is working as part of a social enterprise project to construct Mwamba, Uganda's first world-class climbing gym. To make the sport more accessible, the gym will offer affordable pricing, communal climbing sessions, and inclusive instruction designed for individuals of all abilities. The new gym is not just an obligation, but my personal goal, Mr. Sabawa says. So let's take a look at the photographs now in our, let's see, our first one. We have Feet of Strength. Amar Sasir climbs at Mainga Quarry in Kampala, Uganda, wearing shoes donated to the Mountain Club of Uganda. This is a close-up photograph, and on a sheer rock, a rock wall face, what you see are the feet. His feet are gripping the side of the mountain here, and that's really all you can see in the photograph. But you can see the feet are bending, stretching, and really making a deep connection to that rock wall. Then in number two, photo two, it's titled Upwardly Mobile. Mr. Yasser, a Sudanese photographer based in Kampala, is on his first climb at Mainga. This one, the camera pulls back a bit so you can see the entire body of the climber. He is roped in. So he is connected, he has a harness connected to his waist and below his seat, so right at the top of his thighs that hold him in place. And you can see several ropes connecting him there. He is a young black man. He's wearing a sort of a dusty red or desert-colored T-shirt and green pants, and he is wearing hiking boots that are very, they kind of form to the rock wall. They're very flexible. And you can see his hand gripping the rock wall. And you can see his face is looking down at his feet. He is very deep in concentration here. And he's pretty high up off the ground. You can see in the far background, it's a grassy area there. And so you can see that he's high off the ground. Our third photograph is titled Climb Management. Albert Abayo leads a route known as Own the Eggs at Mainga. He and other club members are working to increase community exposure to rock climbing. And in this photograph, let's see if I can share that one with you. It is showing that climber. This one, you can see most of his body. In this photograph, he is really pressing his body closely to the rock face of the wall here. His arm is up over his head. It's found a ledge, and his hands are gripping in really strenuously into the rock face. You can see an amazing picture of his face, the concentration. It looks like he's about to reach out to his next place to place his hands. And so the total concentration in his face is just expertly captured there. Let's see if there are any more photos. We do have a few more. Our next one is titled Peak Performer Miracle Ainamani Sets a top rope at the quarry. The mobile money agent occasionally fits in an afternoon climbing session before evening church services. So Miracle, the climber here, he is standing on top of the rock formation. So he's at its peak. He's wearing a red helmet to protect him if he hits his head. He's wearing a red t-shirt and dark slacks. And he is roped up. It's pretty dramatic. You can see the valley and the entire community below him in the far distance. But where he is in profile looking over the rock ledge. And he has many ropes attached to a kind of sort of a tool belt that he's wearing around his waist. And then he has other ropes in his hands. In our next photograph, it's called Soul Provider. Individuals and climbing groups have donated all the club's gear. This is a close-up image of a gym bag. And in the gym bag, you see climbing shoes, ropes, all the tools of the trade that you'll need to scale a mountain. And then in photograph number 6, it's titled Rockstar. Mr. Abayo climbs along a route called Side Pull at the quarry. This photograph is shot from underneath the climber. The climber itself is a little bit out of focus, where the focus is on the rock face itself. And it's a very dramatic vertical shot from below and then showing up this rock face. And even though the climber is blurry, you can see that it's a black man and he's wearing a dark t-shirt. And then his arm is extended. His left arm is extended. He just found a ledge and he is gripping with great intensity that ledge to hold him up. And that concludes the content. Now we do have on the very last page, we have a full page ad. So let me read that to you as well. It reads, Smuckers waiting for the peak of perfection. With a name like Smuckers, it has to be good. Smuckers.com. And what we see here in the foreground is a jar of Smuckers strawberry preserves. There's on the label. There are strawberries still attached to the leaves there. And you can see the glass jar and see the strawberries, even see the seeds within those strawberry preserves there. And then behind that, you see a dramatic image. It does look like an old-timey image. It looks like from long ago. It kind of has a patina to it, a faded quality. And in the image, there are two boys. They look about 8 and 10 years old. They're both wearing t-shirts and blue jeans. And we're seeing the back of them, and they're looking up into a fruit tree. And their burst of red fruit in that fruit tree. And then in the far distance, you see farmland as far as you can see in the distance, and everything is green and growing in that image. We'll move to the magazine now. We're on the website, and our first article here is titled California's Take on a Housing Crisis: Aim for Abundance, Reap Affordability. This article was written by Allie Martin, a staff writer. It was published on October 31st, 2025. The dateline is Santa Monica, California. And let's see, in the middle of the page, we have a yellow rectangle, and it says, while we wrote this, one answer to an affordability gap in housing, experts say, is building more units to try to ease the pressure on prices. That can mean changing laws that regulate where and what kinds of housing can be built. At the top of the page, we have a construction site. It's a photograph. And the caption reads, "Construction workers frame out a multi-home residential project in Encinitas, California, July 21st, 2025. And we see an aerial view overlooking this construction site. And you can see the construction workers look like busy bees. You see construction workers, there are about a half dozen of them, and they're all over the place at different levels and different places within this construction site. And what you really just see is the framework of the wood framing of this multi-house unit that's going to be going up. So let's get to the article now. Trisha Crane stands at the corner of Wilshire Boulevard and 26th Street in Santa Monica. A few blocks from her home, pointing out a stretch of businesses that will be replaced with a 170-unit apartment building. A Starbucks is already closed. A store selling chairs and mattresses is still open, but not for much longer. This block, just 2 miles from the beach, is scheduled to be redeveloped in January. Facing a budget crisis and a state mandate to create more housing, members of the city council, she says, are just doing whatever they can to get more units built. The 8-story building will stand out among its mostly 1 to 3-story neighbors. It's one of a half dozen developments that will add over 1,000 units to this coastal city of 91,000 people next to Los Angeles. Average monthly rent is about $3,500 here, among the highest in the United States. Ms. Crane is concerned that the addition of these market-rate units in the highly desirable beach community won't do anything to bring prices down. "We are losing our middle class," she says. But these are the type of projects that pro-housing advocates hope to see more of, and California is making them easier to build. Over the past few months, Governor Gavin Newsom signed a slate of laws aimed at eliminating a deficit of 2.5 million housing units. In support of more and denser housing, lawmakers relaxed the state's landmark environmental rules, cleared the way for multi-unit housing near transit hubs, streamlined building permits, created new funding programs for developers, and increased tax credits for renters. The laws are, in part, designed to promote units that are affordable, generally defined as costing no more than 30% of a family's income. They move California in the right direction, says Sherry Lawson Clark, a cultural anthropologist at Wake Forest University who studies housing and poverty. If California, where mid-tier homes cost more than twice the nationwide average, can narrow the affordability gap with an influx of new housing, then it could perhaps be a blueprint for other states and localities, she says. At this point in the article, there's a photograph. The caption reads, "Trisha Crane stands a few blocks from her home in front of a half-shuttered commercial building that is scheduled to be replaced with a 170-unit apartment building October 9, 2025, in Santa Monica, California. In the photograph, we see Trisha Crane standing before the building. She has blonde hair that's pulled back and tied behind her head there. She's wearing glasses, a blue denim shirt, some appears to be white slacks, and she's holding a hammer, it appears, in her hands. And then she's standing in front of this building that has paper covering all of the windows. And then there's a notice on the wall. It says, "Notice of pending demolition permit." And then I can't read any of the rest of it, but there's other coding and other information there about this demolition permit there. So let's get back to our article. The Golden State's effort faces significant obstacles. Factors like the high cost of construction, concentration of relatively high earners, and high interest rates affect how much it costs to build, buy, and rent units, which directly impacts their accessibility. In fact, California has enacted a series of reforms over the last decade, only for the crisis to persist. A recent study by the McKinsey Institute for Economic Mobility estimates the U.S. is short 8.2 million housing units, 32% more than 10 years ago. Despite decades in which laws have often moved toward more streamlined permitting and denser housing, the limited supply, says the report, has kept rents and homes prices high. California's need for more housing units, plus a growing disparity between income and housing cost, calls for a both-and solution, says William Fulton, professor of practice at the University of California, San Diego's Department of Urban Studies and Planning. Quote, "You have to build way more housing in general," he says, "but you also need to build as much affordable housing as you can." New laws could change California landscape. A long-standing state law requires cities to have plans for meeting projected housing needs and to update those plans every few years. About two-thirds of Santa Monica's existing housing stock is in buildings with five or more units, according to a 2023 analysis by the Santa Monica Daily Press. The city's building target is nearly 9,000 new units by 2030. Just over a third of that, 3,400, has been completed. Nearly all of it is in multifamily or mixed-use buildings. The new law that allows for more housing near transit hubs clears the way for high-rises of up to 9 stories and overrides any local ordinances. The wide-ranging reforms reflect the complexities of housing affordability. "There isn't a silver bullet here," says Mr. Fulton. "Homes get built at the market's highest end, where profits are higher, and at the very low end, because that construction is subsidized. But very little new housing is being built for people making $100,000 a year," he says. "That's a very complex spot to be in. Rents are going up, and they're the ones who are really getting squeezed." Only 15% of Californians can afford to buy a median-priced single-family home in their state, according to the California Association of Realtors. In 2012, it was 56%. Adding market-rate units, even at the high end, helps ease the shortage and expand affordable options, says Mr. Fulton. As people move into more expensive homes, their less expensive units free up for others to move into. At this point in the story, we have another photograph. It is captioned, "A Bay Area Rapid Transit Train Approaches a Rail Station in Daly City, California, near San Francisco, May 9th, 2025. And basically, we see a train in the photograph moving towards the viewer. And it's kind of snaking around a curve. And then in the far background, you see some dense trees and shrubbery. And then far in the background, you see very dense housing back there. Back to the story. The push to expand the kinds of housing available in California communities could reframe the California dream. As condominium and apartment buildings gain legislative support to outpace single-family homes, like the ranch, craftsman, and Spanish bungalow found throughout the LA area. And one significant obstacle to building condos and apartments no longer exists. Faced with the loss of thousands of homes in the LA wildfires, plus the increasing crisis of affordability, lawmakers agreed on limited reforms that ease restrictions on denser building where infrastructure already exists, generally in urban areas. The new law rolls back the landmark California Environmental Quality Act, waiving its regulations for infill projects and clearing the path for a wide range of development, including single-family homes as well as multi-unit and mixed-use projects. Housing effort has community impact. The new laws will affect residents in different ways. In some areas, developments have the potential to usher in big changes to traffic patterns and demographics. Miss Crane moved to Santa Monica with her husband in 1982. They bought a 1920s Spanish bungalow on a leafy street not far from the planned 170-unit building. If that building goes up, she says, not only will traffic increase on the smaller side streets, but it will make parking more difficult as well. She also laments the loss of businesses along the commercial stretch, which has a mix of restaurants, boutiques, grocery stores, and shuttered storefronts. We're losing community, she says. But the YIMBY movement has had strong backing in the state legislature. Standing for Yes in My Backyard, YIMBY counters the idea of supporting solutions as long as they're implemented somewhere other than near where one lives. That Yes movement, which advocates for more and more dense housing, is championed by State Senator Scott Wiener, who was elected on a pro-housing platform. Governor Newsom campaigned on a promise to lead the state in building millions of units by 2025. Both say increasing the housing supply will ease the state's affordability crisis. California YIMBY declared the state's reform package a landmark victory earlier this month in a newsletter. 2025 was by far the biggest year for pro-housing reforms in our history, the group wrote. But driving around Santa Monica on a tour of the new housing complexes, Miss Crane calls them a gift to the developers. The Monitor reached out to builders and had no response. At this point on the page, we have another photograph. The caption reads, more than 1,000 new apartments are scheduled to be built in Santa Monica, California, a city with about 91,000 residents. One of those developments will replace this stretch of restaurants and services along Wilshire Boulevard. The photograph is taken from the perspective of the street level. It is taken from the sidewalk. You can see the sidewalk here. In the foreground, someone is holding up a blueprint. You can see the blueprint for a large multi-family unit housing development. It looks like a high-rise, 8 or 9 stories high. And then there's, I can't read it on the page, but there's a lot of description of the units and what will be in there. And then beyond the foreground where we see that construction site, we see a one-level old-school retail center. And it looks like a little bit of everything there, and it looks a little bit run down. You can't really see what the storefronts are about, but you can see them in the picture. So let's get back to the article itself. This is not going to generate affordable units, she says. This is driving the middle class out. The National Association of Home Builders published a recent study that determined about 75% of U.S. families could not afford to purchase a median-priced home. For most of the last 20 years, median home prices in the U.S. have exceeded the affordability benchmark of 30% of a family's income. This year, the median cost of housing in the U.S. shot up to nearly 47% of a family's median income. Miracle McKinney aspires to purchase a home, but for now, it's just really survival, she says. Miss McKinney estimates she spends close to 70% of her monthly income on housing, even though she lives in a subsidized apartment. As a volunteer with the nonprofit Alliance of Californias for Community Empowerment, she advocates for policies that keep people housed. Building isn't the only solution, says an ACCE spokesperson. ACCE wants to see more cities pass laws that allow tenants an opportunity to purchase their building if it goes on the market. We are running out of time, so we'll wrap up the article here. Thank you for joining us for Christian Science Monitor, read by Daniel Williams.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of AfterSight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.